You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that states cannot keep same-sex couples from marrying and must recognize their legal unions. It was a landmark moment in the struggle for LGBT rights. In 2019, Pete Buttigieg became the first openly gay candidate for president. The paradigm is largely shifting for people who are LGBT, unless you're serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. This year, the military academies that educate officers for our military branches started to implement the Trump administration's ban on transgender service members. An editorial published in the New York Times this past spring describes what it's like to serve as an openly gay man in the U.S. Army, and that includes the death threats. That editorial was written by Nico Fanning. He was an intelligence officer in the 2nd Battalion, 87th Infantry, from 2011 to 2014. Now he'll be graduating from the University of Michigan with a degree in creative writing and literature. Here is my conversation with Nico. The headline of your editorial is certainly eye-catching, and I'll quote it, "I thought I could live as an openly gay man in the Army, then came the death threats." Why did you feel compelled to write this editorial?
So this was really important to me, looking back on leadership roles as we move forward. You just spoke about Trump's recent ban on transgender service members. And I really wanted leadership positions within the military at all levels to really think about what effect they're having on soldiers when they make these decisions or how they enforce them moving forward. Because the transgender ban is actually only partially a ban. A lot of trans soldiers who are already in will be allowed to stay in. So they may still be continued. They may still continue to be subjugated to some of these prejudices and abuses, regardless of whether they're in or out.
Before we kind of get into some of the experiences you had in the Army, I think we non-military types, we hear that don't ask, don't tell. We hear that talked about, but it was the policy that began under President Clinton in 1994 and lasted until September 2011. But I think we who have not served in the military don't know what it really meant on the ground. First of all, did your dates of service straddle the before and after of DADT?
They do. In some ways, I was fortunate because I was actually able to experience Don't Ask, Don't Tell as it was ending. Mm-hmm. So for about 4 months, I was actually still under the umbrella of Don't Ask, Don't Tell before it was repealed.
Which meant what to someone like you in the service?
It meant I had to be really careful with my language. I couldn't use the word boyfriend. I couldn't have conversations about what I would do on weekends or what it was like attending a gay pride event or really just talking about my day-to-day life. I had to be very careful about the words I used.
What did that do for you inside?
I think for me and for many soldiers who were under the umbrella of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it separates you from the rest of your teammates. And you're supposed to be fostering these bands of unity, and you're not really able to when there's a huge portion of your life you have to consciously conceal.
And then afterwards, what was it like?
Afterwards, it was very freeing. There was definitely kind of a hesitancy period where I still wasn't quite sure whether or not it was okay to talk about. And then I noticed that there were a few other people who started to come out at my training units, and everyone was receiving like kind of overwhelming support. It wasn't an issue for anyone at those two training levels. So that was fantastic.
And when did it become an issue?
It didn't become an issue until my first official duty station, which was in Fort Drum, New York. And that was a couple of weeks after I arrived.
So you've got a lot of incidents that you spell out in your editorial in the New York Times. Give us a few that are really burned in your mind as far as what you went through. There's that headline, then came the death threats, but there was also there were other things that happened. What sticks in your mind?
Yeah, really, other than the death threats, the one that really stuck out to me was being approached by a SHARP representative. And the SHARP representative for every unit is supposed to handle sexual harassment, sexual assault training, awareness, rape prevention. And he approached me after there had been a male-on-male sexual assault the previous night and essentially threatened my career and said that he thought I was at the highest risk of being an offender in the future.
Because you were living as an openly gay man.
Absolutely. And though those words weren't used, he didn't say, because you're gay. Mm-hmm. We asked, why are you saying this later on? And, it was pretty obvious at that point that that's where he was going with it.
But then also you write about someone who then came in and rallied, in a sense.
Absolutely.
So there is support. Talk about that kind of support.
Absolutely. You know, and I think that's that was maybe perhaps one of the downsides of my article, is I didn't really go into detail about all the amazing men and women that were supportive. And I think that there were just an overwhelming amount of people who really supported me throughout my career as well. It's sad to some degree that those incidents were so career impacting, because there were a lot of positive moments as well.
But as you talk about, you said the second week after you arrived at Fort Drum, which was your first and only duty station, the death threats slipped under the door of your barracks room, and they were like, it really hits me. Tell us about the colors and what was written, the contrast between the colors of the paper and what was on it.
Right. So, you know, we use a lot of sticky notes in the military, and we use neon colors. So at first they're kind of, you know, happy and exciting, and or you know that it's very urgent. When it's stuck on your desk, it's very noticeable. And there were just a lot of violent words and threats that were written on in black Sharpie on these kind of brightly colored pieces of paper, which was disconcerting.
You write that you say the moment that you decided to become a soldier and the moment you chose to live as an openly gay man, you say they actually happened just about at the same time. Can you tell us more about those choices?
Absolutely. I was really fortunate that after high school, I was allowed to go and live with a military family member who was stationed in Italy at the time. And he was very supportive of me coming out as gay. He'd kind of suspected already, so he was kind of facilitating that experience. And he was also really supportive of a military career. So at this, he was kind of supporting both of those roles, and I'm not really sure which one happened first.
And I'm sure you had some sense that it would be a tense situation being an openly gay man in the military, but you still entered. You still signed up.
Absolutely.
Why?
There were a couple of reasons. I was confident that Don't Ask, Don't Tell, perhaps naively so, would be the end of some of those discriminatory issues. And I was hopeful that the fact that I was a soldier, and the fact that I knew that I would be good at my job, and the fact that I was in a position where my intellect and my capability mattered more than my sexual identity, would prevent some of those issues. And perhaps that was naive of me to believe that.
So we're allowed completely naivete when we're 19.
Yeah, I hope so.
What do you think of and how do you feel when you see the military today? You've been out now since the end of 2014. What, if anything, encourages you and what worries you?
Absolutely. So after this article, I received an outpouring of messages from LGBT soldiers. And it was both encouraging and distressing, because many of them, about half, you know, addressed the same issues that I was having. And the other half were adamant that these issues no longer existed, at least not in their units. So that kind of was an interesting dichotomy there. I think what worries me the most is our general culture around LGBT soldiers seems to be tense, and yet the Army is unable to meet its requirements for introducing new recruits. We were about 600 or 6,500 people under this year, and yet we refuse to tap into a community of people who are dedicated, hardworking, and intelligent. I think that's just incredibly disappointing.
Would you encourage LGBT men and women today, as we talk in 2019, to join the military?
Absolutely. I think that if that's the military provides a plethora of amazing opportunities, career experience. It offers schooling afterwards. It offers schooling during, if you have, you know, the time and availability. The military is just an excellent stepping stone at the very least. And so I think that having LGBT people, who I believe are just some of the most hardworking and dedicated people that I've met, would only benefit our military and make it more ready in the future.
What's ahead for you after you graduate?
I am potentially moving back to Chicago. I have a deep love of Chicago after having lived there for a few years. And then we'll explore more writing.
More writing. Do you see yourself involved in veterans issues?
Absolutely, yes. LGBT advocacy and veteran issues, seeing where we can merge those two ideas and see how we can make that a better issue on both ends.
Nico Fanning, and you'll find his editorial in the New York Times. It was great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.